Good evening, everybody. It's 9:05 on May 28th. This is our Monday night call. It's Memorial Day, so we're not very full, but that's okay. We still can go over some stuff. It's good to have everybody here, and got a couple things I would like to talk about before we open the queue up. You know, things are very busy, and looks like we only got about 25 people, but that's okay. So, before I take off, do we have any announcements, Jan?
No announcements, really. I do have one. The Natural Healing Group, we have guest lecturers come in, and we have lecturers lined up, but we have an opening. I think it's June 21st, and then we're covered through July 12th, and then on we'll be looking for people who have a good knowledge of some phase of natural healing that would like to talk for, you know, maybe 40 to 50 minutes and then answer a few questions. It'll be on a Thursday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. So if you're remotely interested and you have a good background and would like to talk, even if it takes two sessions, that's fine. We'll just split it in half. And just either call me at 814-531-5363, or you can email me at jan@nationallibertyalliance.org. We do have a, also, let me pull it up quick, a courtroom observer case for this week. I think it's Wednesday or Thursday. Let's see if I can find it quick. Oops, I can't find it quick. I got to go open up some old stuff. Hold on a sec.
Okay, take your time.
Doesn't pay to put things away, does it?
Yeah.
Get you behind the eight ball every time. Okay, here we go. It's for Elena Struan of New York City, and I think Terry from New Jersey sent this out about 4 or 5 days ago. I put it in the newsletter. I'm looking for her date. September. What? Says September 13th. I'm not sure why she wanted to get it in. Therefore, we will revisit it in August or early September. Sorry about
right.
that. I didn't realize it was so far in the future. Okay,
right.
You're off and running there, Gerard. I only have one question tonight, so when we get to that.
Okay. I don't see that John has posted. I didn't realize it wasn't posted on the gun case. Their latest response to us. You don't have that, do you? With
the one that.
Not our response. Their response to us. Oh yeah, it's here. Wait a minute. This I see. Rodriguez. That was their response. They responded with a lot of crazy stuff. Let's see.
Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, they said thank you very much. Well, anyway, I just wanted it in front of me as I was talking. You know, to address some of the stuff they said, that, and just kind of discuss, you know, what our strategy is. A lot of times we don't talk strategy, so we're so busy writing papers and then reading the papers that we write. So I just wanted to go over their response and kind of explain what they opened up by their response, basically. And just bear with me a minute because I'm looking for the response of the assistant attorney general. Now, you know, New York's attorney general was left in disgrace, and they have a woman filling in. I don't know who she is or anything about her, but but we have one of her assistant attorney generals. You know, they probably got 5 to 7 of them running around the state. Hang on, and it was a guy actually that wrote it. Let's see, Rodriguez. Just bear with me, because it'll help if I get this up. Anyway, in their response, they made a lot of claims, unsubstantiated claims about us and what we're doing, and called us sovereign citizens. It almost read word for word, kind of like the Southern Poverty Laws blurb on there about us, which is back up there. I don't know if people know it, where they say we're this and we're sovereigns and we don't believe in the government and all this stuff. But I got to say, the Southern Poverty Law Center did a good job of writing who we are and what we do. And as bad as they tried to make us look, they explained it so well. I think it's a good advertisement. It's like,
yeah,
you know,
so do I.
You know what I mean? I mean, whoever did that, they did a pretty good job, you know. But meanwhile, they're calling us sovereign citizens, whatever that is, and that's exactly what this assistant attorney general did. Hang on, let me see here. I don't see it. I don't see it on our. I don't know why it wouldn't be there.
Is that the Michael McCartan one? There is one from him.
Michael McCartan. Where do you see that? Because that
it's quite a ways down. It's way below Rodriguez. It's about 4 or 5 down below that.
Let's see. Could you lower that, please? It's like really hard for me to hear. Is this starts out with Michael McCartan? I don't see it. I see an order granting defendant's request, notice of filing a motion.
It's called a declaration of Michael G. McCartan.
Defendant's exhibit.
Maybe there's more than one.
Well, it looks to me like there's the last thing that we did up here is the writ of mandamus, right?
Yeah,
then
this
the
one.
Show then the amicus curiae, Rodriguez versus.
It's called the AG Declaration. Is that the one you're looking for? Signed by the Assistant Attorney General.
Oh, that's it. Okay, so it's under defendant. Why is it down there? That's weird.
Yeah, it's right under defendant exhibit. It's the AG Declaration.
Yeah, but that's not the answer. Yeah, that's the Declaration of Michael McCartan. I don't even know what that is. Declare under penalty that I am the assistant. Yes, okay, so... Where's the answer where they answered us? And they made all kinds of...
Well, one of them was a motion to dismiss, wasn't it?
Oh, did they do that? Hang on, let me see. Memorandum of Law, motion to dismiss.
That's signed by the Assistant Attorney General, too.
Oh, yeah, this is it. So what he did was, this is part of the point I'm going to make here. I hope I didn't lose everybody. In this Assistant Attorney General's motion to dismiss, which they made, they didn't even answer the case. They answered with a letter request to extend the time for them to answer in order to put in a motion to dismiss, which is ridiculous. The rules don't even allow for that. You can't come into a case where somebody has brought you in as a defendant and then say, well, I want to extend the time for me to answer from the 30 days that I had. I need another 45 days in order to put a motion in to dismiss. You didn't even answer the case yet. And what, you know what I'm saying? You can't. There has to be some action to move the court in order for you to move the court. So we come in with accusation. They don't even answer our accusation. They make a motion for an extension of time, and in order to go over your time of when you send out your notice and when you get your notice and when you have to answer, there's only very strict few rules that allows the judge to offer you more time, like you were on a plane and it crashed and you couldn't do it. You know what I mean? And so there's two rules in order, if you're a defendant and you need more time to answer, well, anybody that needs more time, anybody that goes back and forth and they get personally served, they get 20 days. If they get served through the mail, they have 30 days. And the only way to get that extended is two reasons. It has to be something earth-shattering that was totally out of your control. And number two is you have to show that you would have probably won if you got your chance to answer. So both of those things need to be in place before you can get an extension. And, of course, neither of them are in this case. You know, what does the state need more time to answer for? They got our tax dollars. They got a whole army of lawyers up there, and they couldn't answer us in 30 days. They need more time, and they didn't answer anyway. They want more time in order to put a motion to dismiss in, which is ridiculous. But besides that, not only did he not answer the case and just made a motion to dismiss, but he proceeds to try to argue the case without answering us in his motion to dismiss. And he brings up some old case that we had a couple of years ago that was never ruled on. It kind of went out on a technicality. So, you know, he's calling it, we can't bring this case up, it's collateral estoppel because it's already been in here once. Well, it never went in. It never made it in, because it got dismissed on a technicality before it went in, so therefore it was never adjudicated. It was never ruled on. So in order for it to be collateral estoppel, it has to be something that actually went through the process of being argued and then finished, lost or won. Then it's collateral estoppel. This guy is bringing up a case that we ended up letting drop for whatever reason, and it wasn't really adjudicated, so you can't put collateral estoppel on that and say, well, we already discussed this, because you didn't discuss anything really. So in his request for more time in his memorandum of law, he's throwing a bunch of stuff in that would technically, he doesn't believe we're going to be able to answer, because he's making a motion to dismiss. He hasn't answered this in the first place, and he has no intention to ask this in the second place, because basically the judge gave him another 45 days to answer, to put his motion to dismiss in, and he's hoping the judge dismisses it and we never get to answer. So he's actually, it's kind of fraud. He's using the court to commit fraud. That, you know, and so that's where he's at. So what we need to do is we need to address that. But the other thing we need to address is the fact that they labeled us with all these labels with no proof. This is, we have to put this guy in the case now, or we could take him off on his own, and the judge too, because the judge shouldn't have allowed him to do this. You know, the judge should know better, that he's using the court and he's making these claims nobody's been convicted on our of anything in NLA ever. We've had numerous visits from the FBI, and we always tell them what we're doing and how we're doing it through the court, and we send everybody a copy of our paper. And what is a sovereign citizen anyway, and how do you become one, and where are they, and what's their organization? It's a bunch of baloney. You know, just because we use Jefferson's words and we use the Supreme Court's words, that makes us sovereign citizens? I mean, where is that written? So he's on shaky ground. Like, you know, Bill Thornton, who was one of our mentors, he said, look, if you don't want to argue it, don't bring it up. All the stuff that he brought up in this answer is stuff that he needs to answer now, because he brought it up. So he's really, really stuck his neck out. And actually, this is libel. It's also defamation of character. It's a lot of things that we're going to talk about. And we are going to hold his feet to the fire on this, because, you know, law enforcement, they got these little catch-all phrases and catch-all things that they want to label people on. As a matter of fact, they even came out with a new law about law enforcement labeling people for the purpose of keyholing them, which is exactly what he's trying to do. Is he's trying to cloud our paperwork, telling everybody that we're a sovereign citizen group, that he doesn't need to read us because they've already been ruled on, you know. So anyway, I thought it was pretty interesting that he would go there. I think he's going to be sorry he went there, because I don't think that he's going to be able to defend his position here, and the name calling that he did is pretty bad, you know, for him to put that out there on paper in a case. I mean, he can't even deny it. It's like in writing. It's not something that you would do, that you should do in a court. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this goes. And certainly we're going to go over everything he said here and put it under a microscope and send it back into him, dust it off, load it up, and shoot it back at him. And I don't know how they're going to answer, because he didn't answer the first time. The reason he did this is they couldn't answer, because they can't reply to the law. You know, it's like Brent says, the answer to lawlessness is the law. And basically what we wrote in there is the law, and he cannot answer the law. Our case shows where they've left the law. I mean, he brought up stuff that the Sullivan Act, New York State has had some kind of gun control since the 1600s. Well, no kidding, you dingbat. That's why we broke away from England. As a matter of fact, I think the first shots over here were the fact that the British were trying to take the colonists' guns. So, you know that was the first gun control, and yeah, we had a revolution over it. You know, New York's had gun control since the 1600s, and the Sullivan Act, Mr. Sullivan, was a crime boss. He was doing extortion and protection and all this stuff. And what happened is when he was sent his thugs around to collect his money, the storekeepers armed themselves with pistol and they were shooting his men. And so nobody wanted to collect his protection. So he came out with a law that nobody could have a concealed weapon, a sawed-off shotgun or a pistol, because his guys were getting picked off like flies and he was having trouble collecting. So they quote the Sullivan Act like it was some great act. Well, that was an act that was put in by a crooked politician. And these are facts. These are facts of history. So, you know, his argument is so, babyish, like, you know what I mean? Why would you go there? It doesn't even make sense. What I wanted to say was juvenile. It's a juvenile argument, because he's assuming nobody knows anything. Like, you're going to go over there and tout the Sullivan Act and the fact in 1600. I mean, we're going to put that in there, too. Look, the first shots were fired was because they wanted to take our guns away. Yeah, it was 1600. That's one of the big things that caused the revolution, you know. And, I mean, look, they were doing things like taking people to England that they were arresting here because they couldn't get a jury to convict them. So the king said, that's okay, put them on a boat and send them over here. Well, that was the Patriot Act, basically. Send them here, we'll convict them here, you know. So, of course, back then it took you 3 months in the hull of a ship to get there, you know. But there's nothing, their tactics aren't anything new. And this guy thinks everybody's stupid, that we don't know history. And obvious, well, actually, if you think about it, they don't know history. A lot of these guys are young. They went through law school in a post 9/11 world. They think that this is normal. They don't remember what I remember and what Terry remembers and us older people remember. And that's why it's very important to keep your old folks like us around, because otherwise we can't tell you these things and you'll go out and make the same mistakes over again, and you'll end up living history. You'll end up living it all over again, because there's nobody to say, oh, no, we tried that, it doesn't work. And that's exactly what's going on with these attorneys. They have no idea. They've been through dumbed down schools. You know, they 9/11 was how many years ago? What was it, in 2002? You know, a lot of these guys, I know that they are out of law school, after that. And some of them were born, around then too. So they don't really know what they're talking about. They're going to have trouble arguing a case from a common law and from a constitutional standpoint when they don't even really know what the Constitution is. They don't teach it in law school. They barely brush on it, you know. And I mean, my goodness, they said Obama was a constitutional scholar, and that was a joke, you know. Anyway, we got all these people and all these judges, and I mean, the first judge we came in contact with was the chief judge in New York, which was Gail Prudente. Well, she got her law degree somewhere in overseas in Switzerland or something. She was not an American. She doesn't understand America or the Constitution, and she makes statements like the common law was abrogated, you know, in New York, because when the Constitution was put in, what they did is they put a line in there and they said, look, at any contracts that were in effect before this Constitution under the old common law, they're still in effect, except where it disagrees with the Constitution, in which case the legislator can go in and change it or abrogate it. But they were only talking about those specific areas, not that the common law was abrogated, because the common law, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution are common law documents. If common law has been abrogated, then those documents don't stand. Our forefathers said that you can't even understand the Constitution without the underpinnings of common law, because that's what it's written on. Of course, these guys don't know that, and some of these judges even, look at our chief judge, doesn't understand where our heritage comes from. And I know why, because she was raised outside of the country. And we had that other little guy that was running around when we were going over to Burns, and he got in between us and the Bundys, and he's the guy that talked them into filling out his paperwork, which went nowhere. They're all arrested now. But he was not an American citizen. He read up on the Magna Carta, but he has no idea the checks and balances of America, and he was going out there reinstating the Magna Carta to the point of where they put the axe to the king's neck, and then taking and putting liens and stuff with no due process. You see, we came from England, and the Magna Carta was a big part of it, of what we are, but we also, when we came from England, we fixed the things that weren't quite right with England, that they did to us. This Constitution in this country was because of those things, when the king violated our natural rights. And actually, it is very strong in England because, you know, the Queen took an oath to the Magna Carta that it was under that she received her power under natural rights, under God's laws, and that it would always be in place. So it's almost as strong as ours, except for they don't have the separation, the separate branches like we do, that where one can trump the other one, and so there's a check and balance. They don't quite have that, you know. So our country was more perfected in the common laws than theirs were. Our Bill of Rights really, you know, nailed down with what the government couldn't do. The Constitution tells them how they're to operate, and the Bill of Rights tells them it's actually called the Bill of Prohibitions. It was things that they were prohibited from doing. So, and they don't quite have that like that in England and Ireland and Australia. And right now they have a lot, you know, they've been watching us like hawks. They got some horrible stuff going on over there. They just arrested this journalist and put him in jail with no trial. They ordered the media not to say anything about it. So basically they now have a George Orwell 1984 government in England as of now, because of the things that have gone on over there. And I look at, we know, you know, this Tommy Robertson, who was a journalist that was writing about the gang rapes the Muslims were doing on these girls, these underage and even just adult girls, but, you know, raping them and killing them and getting away with it. And he was talking about how they have not gone after this, and they let them go, and they arrested him for talking about it. And they had him arrested, and they had him tried and thrown in jail all within about 24 hours. They had a cell ready. They had a judge ready. And they also put an order out in England. They can order the newspapers not to talk about an event due to national security. Where have you heard that before? This is exactly what's going on in this country. And so England, I guess, wanted to beat us. They actually made an order to the press that they should not report on this particular case with this Tommy Robertson. So, you know, we know the media here is not reporting on anything, but the government doesn't make a blatant decree that the news media is not supposed to report on it. They just don't report on it because they're all run by the same corporations that's running the government is running the media. And we know that. We understand that. We also understand that we're in the battle of our lives right now in order to take this down. And thank God, you know, we have Donald Trump, you know, doing these things that's going to empower us. And even in this case, we're hopeful that they're going to watch what's going on. He just set something like 7 new Supreme Court, District Court judges, and a marshal and another prosecutor down here. And so it looks like New York, you know, our courts are going to probably get straightened up before other ones, because Donald Trump's a New Yorker and he knows the evil that's here. And don't forget, you know, Hillary, this is her land here. This is where she went. So if he knows one thing, he certainly knows the Eastern courts, because he's been operating in this system here. So I'm hoping that that's going to help us in our cases in court, that maybe, you know, we'll be able to get a judge that will actually, you know, let us do the rule of law and let us have our untainted jury, we can hope. Anyway, that's all I have to say. That's basically what's going on with these cases. And, you know, and there's a good video on this. You should go look at this. Paul Weston, the Orwellian jailing of Tommy Robinson in England. They're all up in arms, and it's looking like, you know, they're standing outside the jail and the parliament. There's people, you know, rattling. Of course, they don't have any guns over there, but I talked to one guy that's from over there, and he said the sale of crossbows have gone through the roof. So I don't know. I don't think I want to get hit with a crossbow. And I said, well, you know what works real good too is the wrist rocket slingshot. They outlawed them in New York. And he said, oh, we're going to have to look into them. So, you know, people are angry. And when people have nothing to lose anymore, you know what happens? They lose it. And that's what's going on in England. And of course, right now, because of the big pedophilia rings and all this stuff that's in the government, which runs so deep, and the drug running that's run by our own CIA, and if you don't know that, you should know it. It's all over the place. That's what his presidential order, the executive order that he wrote, was going after. This is worldwide, and what we're doing is affecting the big boys that run everything, like Rothschilds. And it's not just the Clintons and the Bushes. The Clintons and the Bushes are the puppeteers. They're up there in the puppeteer, but they're the ones, they're being funded by Soros and Rothschild and Rockefeller. Those are the guys that are running the world, and those are the guys that are getting hurt right now, because with this whole pedophilia thing and using the laws that they put in place under the Patriot Act, Donald Trump has been able to freeze their assets worldwide. So they said, oh, you got to sign this emergency order. Every president since Roosevelt has done it, because we can't operate, because Roosevelt put us under a bankruptcy, and the money wouldn't be legal unless we're under a state emergency. So we've been under a state of emergency since the Second World War. So anyway, Donald Trump took that, he said, okay, I'll make an executive order, and he dutifully did so, but in the order, he changed it around. He said, oh, we're under a state of emergency because we have enemies, foreign and domestic, and here's these 7 corporations, and anybody that's involved with them or helps them or aids them and embeds them, we can take away all their stuff too. Well, those are the 7 corporations that the Clinton Foundation has been doing business with, you know, spreading drugs and pedophilia throughout the world. And the legacy of those years is the fact that child trafficking, human trafficking, and child trafficking now exceed illegal drugs in the money that these people bring in. And so they're in a panic now because their money is cut off, and they've been doing all kinds of evil stuff to try to, and they're trying to regain their footing, because the money's not coming in anymore because it's been cut off. And every phone call and every text and every communication, unless they happen to be able to meet face-to-face, and it's very hard for them to do that because they have to buy a plane ticket, and those are tracked. So if they're meeting, then the NSA knows where they're meeting. And Donald Trump has access to all of that now. And that's why they're really pushing hard, because it's the best thing they can do right now is make trouble, is make war. They would love World War III to get them out of the trouble that they're in, because they can't put the genie back in the bottle. And it's going to start coming out faster and faster as we go through this summer. You're going to see more and more. And people go, I don't see no arrest. You know, Hillary's still walking around, blah, blah, blah. You know, you don't take down a huge empire in one day. And you don't take the top guy out. You got to take his rat lines out. And that's exactly what they did. There's an ex-CIA agent. He was FBI, CIA, and he took down one of the big, big drug cartels in Mexico. I don't remember if it was Escobar or one of them. And he said, it took us many years of digging and getting information before we could take them down. And he said, this worldwide, I don't know, for lack of a better term, new world order that's in there, that Mexican drug cartel was like a pimple on them. It was nothing compared to the long-reaching international dealings of the evil, dark state cartel that has been running for over 80 years with their plans in place, and they're very close to locking us down. This is a respite for us right now. They were sure that they were going to be done. Thank God Hillary didn't get in there, because we'd be in the FEMA camps now, and I have no doubt in my mind. There was a time when I wouldn't want to say that, because I'd be attacked. But we have the evidence now. We have all the evidence. It's all out there. And so, they never worried about their communications with each other, because they figure, who's going to get us? We are the NSA. Nobody's going to come after us. Well, everything they ever typed, everything they ever wrote, everything they ever said, every phone call, every text, it was all being recorded. When Hillary was bleach bidding and banging up her computers with hammers, it didn't matter. The information was already captured. She thought she got rid of it. She didn't get rid of it. She went over into where did she go recently? Somewhere in Scandinavia recently. I forget which country it was. But when she went over there, she brought a phone with her that was made through iPhone, and they told her that these phones would be untraceable, that the NSA wouldn't be able to trace them. So she went over there, and she made calls back across the ocean, back to America, down to wherever, and Donald Trump got a hold of whoever in the government over there, and they said, tell her that you can't read the phone. And that's what he told her, and then they put on this Q thing, this Q that's giving clues that's supposedly close to Donald Trump, put pictures of those cell phones from that company being loaded on a plane, and he said, we see everything. We know everything. And that was to her, because she went over there and said, the phones are good, and they went blah, 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 and they let go everything that they were going to say, and he got all of it. The NSA got all of it. So they played them once again. So they're, so I don't say that they don't have the means of doing something. I mean, the only thing they can do now is false flags and try to create World War III. But, you know, that's why we're in very, very dangerous times right now, because they are so desperate, you know. And, you know, look, we're up there in the courts with these guys that a lot of them they put there only because they had the goods on them. Going up in high-end government in America has been like becoming a made man in the mob. I hate to say it. They make sure that they get something on you, or you don't ever get there in the first place, or if you do get there, you don't stay there. So they have this information on everybody. Everybody that gets in there, they always manage to compromise them sooner or later, and then to use that blackmail to get them to do their bidding. So right now, all that information is out there. It's in the good guys' hands as well as the bad guys' hands. But now we're almost on more of an equal footing than we've ever been. So that's why it's so important that we respond to this paperwork and we push hard now at a time when there's a chance that we can actually get a good prosecutor and a judge that will rule with the rule of law and allow, you know, look, they don't even want to allow us to state our case in court and to put it in front of a jury of the people. They don't want that. It's not enough control for them. Look, they lost the trials with the Bundys and the Hammonds. They lost those trials with tainted juries. They lost them. You think they want to go up against us with a good jury and a good judge? I don't think so. And they know. They know that they won't win. And so that's where we're at. But anyway, I'm going to stop. I've been going long enough. I don't know. Did you say you had a question, Jan? Somewhere? Or did we do them already?
Yep, I just had to get unmuted. Yeah, I have one question tonight. It's kind of a run-on, so wait till I finish, because it's really all tied into one simple question. It's on the national popular vote. And
I'm sorry, I'm going to let people get in the queue while you're reading the question. Go ahead.
Okay, that's fine. It says, please comment on national popular vote as I am receiving surveys asking whether national popular vote should be a law. This would allow California, New York, Florida complete control over the other 47 states because they have the largest populations in the nation. Could you spend some time on educating freedom lovers of the dangers of a national popular vote?
Okay. Well, you know, I never understood when I was a kid. They said there's an electoral college and you get every state gets so many votes, you know, as far as your senators and your congressmen. And that was designed so that out of the 50 states, at least the states would get equal representation. Also, the 17th Amendment, where the legislators used to send two senators up, they killed that by making that a national popular vote. You know, we have the Congress as our representatives. The states need the senators as their representatives. So what we're doing is we stole the states' votes from them by letting the people, because now politics comes in more into the agenda and they can control it more with a national popular vote of the senators. But I digress. The whole idea behind the Electoral College, which I don't know why they couldn't explain it to me when I was a kid, and it sounded very crazy. They, oh, you know, a president could get more votes than a candidate could get more votes than this candidate and yet not be the president because the other guy got the electoral vote. Well, the electoral vote, there's so many electoral votes needed to carry the nation in order to be president because each state gets two votes in the electoral college, or basically. And so if you don't get enough electoral votes, even if you get the popular vote, you don't get in. And the reason, and that's the same reason we don't run a democracy, because what's a democracy? Why do we have a republic with split powers, three equal yet branches of government? We do that so for in a sense of fairness, so that you don't have the most populated states, New York and California, is dictating to the rest of the country who have almost like different lifestyles and different customs and different weather and different economies and all that. We would not be powerful if we ran a mob rule, a democracy-type government. And so national popular vote is a horrible idea because we know that the Clintons and the, you know, I don't want to go Democrat, Republicans, it's mostly Democrats, but they all play this game. They depended on the vote from undocumented illegal immigrants coming in, millions of them, giving them voter registration cards so that they can bump up the number so they can put their candidate in. So it just becomes a mob of getting those necessary votes. If there was no other check and balance in there, that's all they would have to do. And that's what they did do. You know, that's what was attempted. I mean, Hillary just thought she was going to win for sure because in those swing states where they needed the electoral votes, they made sure that they had them bought and paid for, basically. But that was set asunder because they were watching those states and they were watching the fraud that was going on. and they didn't allow it to happen. And she didn't get the votes where she needed them, where she thought that she had them bought and paid for. So she didn't win. So that was a good thing. And that's all I can say. I don't know. I never knew that it was that simple, that that we just didn't want a mob rule. Not everything. Look at if in America we're a nation of laws and principles, it doesn't matter what everybody wants. If everybody thinks it's a great idea to if you have more than 2 children, you got to kill the third one. Or that you should kill the last born or whatever, and everybody votes on it, and it's a majority vote. Does that make it right? No, it's still murder. It violates the laws of nature and nature's God. You can't do it. I don't care how many votes you have. That's a fundamental principle that there's certain fundamental principles you just cannot violate because it goes against who we are and what we are. And I don't care if everybody wants to do it and there's only one guy that's standing against it, or even if there's nobody standing against it, you will suffer the consequences of those things. And a lot of what we've allowed to go on is what we're reaping now, what we've sowed regulated immigration that's coming in here and all this crime. I mean, England is overrun by radical Muslims. You know, I mean, 2 years ago you said radical Muslim, they'd come and sue you and take you off the air and they just jailed this guy for talking about the radical Muslims raping these girls for 30 years. They've been ignoring it. And now they're overrun and they just got their first radical Muslim, parliament member that's heading their parliament, and that's why this guy's in jail now, because he's a journalist that was reporting on it, and they swept him up off the street, and that's where we're headed. That's next. I mean, the way they are, if that comes here, I'll be the next to go. I already said too much tonight. I'll be for sure sitting in jail someplace, you know? So that's the answer to that. I guess that's what I got. Hey, is Brent here tonight?
Yes, Brent is here.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good.
Yes. He's unmuted, too.
Well, hang on a minute, Brent. I'm gonna take the two. Well, we only have two people in the queue. I don't know if I want to do them now, or we'll let Brent go and then we'll do them after. Do I hear a vote, Brent?
Oh, I'm. That's too big a too hard a decision for me. I'll do whatever you want. So if you want me to go now, and you want to take a breather from talking, maybe.
Yeah, go do that. Go ahead, because okay. I got to fill my water up. My mouth is dry.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, thanks. And again,
okay, you go ahead.
He just described. I was listening and thinking as he was talking. He described why I'm willing to come on and talk. It's not because they're in L.A. is paying me. Well, of course, they're not paying John Girard either, I don't imagine. But they're not paying me. But I do this because I am of the conviction that if I don't do it, there'll come a time when the powers that be will try to stop me from doing it. And when we exercise our right of free speech responsibly, that means especially when you say things that are true, that are really true, and that's what we're trying to do here, then you preserve it. You don't lose it. You don't use it. You lose it. So if you have an appropriate opportunity to say something, I was at a meeting in New Hampshire a year ago, maybe 2 years, I don't know, time flies. I was invited to come speak at their Free State Conference, pretty big conference they have there. It's, I don't know, some kind of a fairground. Somebody drove me there. I didn't know where I was. It was out mountain someplace. And I made my presentation about the law of the land versus the law of the city, the common law versus the Roman code. And when I got done, there was an Oriental man sitting on the front row. We were in a tent, and he was sitting on the front row, and he was acted like he was excited about what I was saying. We got done. He said, I can't tell you how exciting this is to me. I said, why is that? He said, I just didn't know that anybody took that point of view. And he said, you have been at it longer than I have, I think. He said, you know more than me. But he said, you hit the nail on the head as far as I can understand it. And I said, well, my pleasure, and that's encouraging. Thanks for letting me know. And he got to talking, and I don't remember how it came out, but it came out he was Islamic, young Oriental man. He was Korean. He was from Korea. Came here when he was a little boy. He told me that a Baptist family, a Southern Baptist family, adopted him. He was raised Southern Baptist. And then he got into a bit of the soup with the courts. I don't know exactly what happened. I didn't understand everything he was saying. But at age 17, he went to state prison. And he came out Islamic. And he said to me something about what that fellow's name, Muhammad. And he, because I had said that the writers of the Bible, he had asked a question. I said, well, the writers of the Bible are, they were men just like us. They were beset by sin and guilt just like us. And that's what the Bible says about them in the book of Hebrews. But yet God used them to make the straight lick with the crooked stick. They wrote the Bible. And by the way, he did the same thing with the Virgin Mary. She was a sinner, born of man, of the seed of man. But God used her to make a straight lick with a crooked stick. And she gave birth to the perfect, sinless Son of God, the Messiah of mankind. Well, I said that. And he blew a proverbial head gasket. I said, why are you upset? He said, well, if the prophets of God, to be prophets, they must be sinless. And then that's when he started talking about Muhammad, I believe. I said, you are joking with me, aren't you? He said, no. I said, that's ridiculous. I said, that's childish. I said, if you're serious, that's just downright stupid. And he said, Muhammad this, and Muhammad was the greatest prophet. I said, well, you're not going to talk that way in my presence. One of us got to go. You're not to talk that way is to demean, to blaspheme God and his Messiah. You won't do it in my presence. And I don't say that I chose to say that. It just welled up inside of me, and it came out when I was enraged. And I was glad I was. Now that it was over, it made a scene. And it was him trying to shout me down. And I said, well, you can try to shout me down, but you won't do that in my presence without resistance. It's not going to happen. And I thought when it was over, not just about that particular point, but about any point that's true. The Islamic people come in, and the wackos and the weirdos, and there's not many of them, and they begin to run over people. I had a fellow tell me recently he's running for the state house. Won't say where, but he's running for the state house. And he lives in a place that it's kind of touchy. There are a lot of sexually compromised people there, to put it nicely, sodomites, lesbians. And he said that he had discovered after studying the matter that only a small percentage, really, compared to everybody else, are those kind of people. But they end up carrying elections for people. And the reason is because they scream and holler and shout, and people are cowed because they don't want to confront that kind of ugliness. And they are ugly. You talk back to them, they'll go to the internet, they'll slander you. I've seen this happen. They'll post ugly pictures on your, send them to you on your Facebook page. I'm ugly. I won't describe how ugly, but ugly. You wouldn't want to look at them. That's the nature of the useful idiots of the evil empire. And when you're dealing with them, you're dealing with, well, as Peter the Apostle said, he put it this way. He said, unreasoning beasts. The old King James says brute beast. That's an old word that means without reason. just dumb animals. But Peter the Apostle doesn't say they're dumb animals. He says they are. He uses the comparative as dumb animals. He's careful there. Of course they aren't dumb animals, but I say the same thing, just quoting him in principle, that they are as unreasoning beasts, dumb, stupid animals. You're not going to reason with them. And if you try to, what will happen is what Solomon said in the book of Proverbs. They will either rage or they will laugh, and there will be no peace. So to try to reason with the unreasonable is a waste of time. To put it in more colloquial terms, my father still tells me that you cannot deal with an unprincipled man in a principled way. Makes me giggle because I've seen him deal with people and unprincipled people. But he said you can't use principle. Don't think you can. Now, he was a Cold War veteran. I suppose that was what he was thinking when he was on the other side of the world. And it's true, of course. There's no, if people are unprincipled and they have no limits, and those useful idiots of the evil empire have no limits, their lust of their flesh and the pride of life and the vainglory of life, the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh control their actions. Their brain doesn't. And it is those ones that are entirely under that control that make the most noise, and because people don't want the ugliness of the confrontation. I understand that, but it doesn't work. There has to be the confrontation. If we are going to retain our freedoms, well, let me get to that fundamental document called the Declaration of 76. Again, excuse me, my comments are mine, may or may not be the point of view of National Liberty Alliance. Paragraph 26 of the Declaration of 76. Speaking of King George, but he called himself emperor in the American colonies. He wasn't king here, he was emperor, and that tells the story of the problem. Speaking of him, paragraph 26 says, "He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burned our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people." A simple statement. Let me read it again. Think about what's going on here. "He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burned our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people." Pretty strong words. Now, how is that different from what the Danes, the Vikings, did to England back in the 8th century? Rape, plunder, pillage, and burn. Rape, plunder, pillage, and burn. That's what they did. And it's seldom said, but history reveals that that's what the British were doing to the American colonies. And in doing so, of course, it destroyed, as it says, the lives of our people. These accusations are strong, yet true. On the 23rd August, 1775, George III issued a proclamation declaring that all 13 of the American colonies were in a, quote, state of rebellion. In October of that year, 1775, British forces burned the town of Falmouth, Maine. By the way, the name of that town now is Portland. Portland, Maine, they burned her. In a word, the British had reverted to the brutalities of her early Scandinavian immigrants, the Danes, the Vikings. And any other government, as any other government, the only tool that King and Parliament had to dominate the American colonies was force and threat of force. Keep this in mind. The only tool government has to get its will, this has always been true, and it always will be true among the governments of man until the Messiah returns. The only tool the government has is force and threat of force. Well, I shouldn't say it just that way. When the Messiah returns, he will have that tool too, but he will use it perfectly, the Bible tells us. Look at him askance, look at him cross-eyed, and he'll annihilate you. He carries a rod of iron. A sword comes out of his mouth, speaking of his word, to be obeyed. He'll do that, but the difference is, of course, he's perfect. He's without sin. He's not a useful idiot of the evil empire, as these men were. Force and threat of force, that's all they've got. And when that doesn't work, they've got one option left. Greater force and more threats of force. That's all they've got. Never forget that. What they don't have is the truth when they, of course, exceed the bounds of lawful government. They don't have the truth. They don't have the high ground. And they've got God setting his face against them. Don't forget that. They'll pile it up. They'll get them sooner or later. Just make sure you aren't part of that group. You've got to get out. As the Bible says, you've got to get out of Egypt. You've got to get out of Babylon. You've got to get out of the place of judgment. When the judgment falls, as it did in Sodom, the only people that made it were the ones that got out, namely Lot and his two daughters. That was it. He lost the rest of his family. They didn't get out, didn't believe him. Well, force and threat of force is all they have. We have something much greater. We have words, and we have the truth, but if we speak the truth with words, then we will win. I believe that. I believe that on the basis of my reading of history. Now, isn't it something that the great influential thing that came out of our war with Britain was this document? It's a matter of words. And then there was another document that we put in place later after the Articles of Confederation, but both of those. That's where the power was. And then go before the war with Britain, the pamphleteers, they use words. The writs of assistance by James Otis, upon which we base our Fourth Amendment. No warrantless searches and seizures, No warrantless searches and seizures. And then also the pamphlet of Thomas Paine, Common Sense. John Adams said that the pamphlet of James Otis, called Writs of Assistance, was the birthing. The child of America was born with that pamphlet. And of course, no pamphlet did more to invigorate the colonies than Common Sense by Tom Paine, an argument from the Old Testament of the Bible, an argument from the text of the Old Testament as to why we should not have a king. The Bible doesn't authorize such a thing, he said. And then he went through the passages that he thought supported that idea. It did more to motivate men than anything else. But what about before the Revolution, the First Great Awakening? A man from England or from Britain came over, Whitfield, George. He went up and down the colonies. Everywhere he went, he spoke to crowds of thousands upon thousands about the Bible. He impressed Ben Franklin so much that Ben started pouring out his bank account to the fella. He said he didn't even agree with everything he said, but he could see he was doing a whole lot of good. So he began to support him. Well, if that hadn't happened, by the way, if George Whitefield hadn't used words, he used words to bring to show the people they had a commonness. And all of the colonies before that time, they all kind of hated each other, frankly. The people in the Northeast, they were all racist to varying degrees. The English Puritans were very proud of their heritage, and they didn't want to mix with the Dutch and German settlers down in Pennsylvania and New York, and vice versa. People will always group up like that. Well, but it was words that drew them together to a common cause, and George Whitefield, more than any other man, did that. So we have that on our side, and it behooves us to speak the truth. You don't have to be ugly about it. don't need to at all. You'll have trouble enough just saying the truth. It'll come to you. You don't have to go looking for trouble, talking ugly, uglier than you have to. And just say right and do right. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Well, Washington said government is neither reason nor eloquence. It is force. We said that. And we added to that threat, of course. But if a people refuse to knuckle under such threat and force, government has no other tool but to ratchet up its force to the level of brutality. Can you imagine? I guess we can imagine. We've seen it in our own country. The British came and burned towns along the coast. Portsmouth. Excuse me. Boy, Gerard, I don't know if I'm going to be able to talk. I'll just keep trying. That place up in Spain, Falmouth. Later called Portland. Well, of course, the federal government has burned up babies and grown-ups. We all remember Waco, Texas. None of the things they charged were going on there. There's no evidence of it. They just burn people up. Just go in and burn them up. Paragraph number 27. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny. Already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous of ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. Now, paragraph 26 was strong. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coast, burned our towns. This one's worse. He is transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries. Of course, he's talking about the Hessians there. To complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny. Cruelty and perfidy. Scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous of ages. Now, that's a strong statement. Well, how barbarous? Well, I can't help but think that Jefferson and the others that ordained this document weren't familiar with the commentaries on the laws of England by William Blackstone. Those were the printing of his lectures given in 1765 at Oxford. He was the first man in the history of Oxford University to lecture concerning the common law. John Wycliffe said, we have to plant the law of the city with the law of the land at Oxford. That was back in about 1370. Not until 1765, a few hundred years later, did that actually happen. Why? Because university is the product of Rome. The whole university system of the whole world is the product of Rome. All universities are fashioned after that first university of Rome at Bologna, Italy. That's where we get our phrase when we say something is baloney, because Bologna is where the first university was established with the express purpose, that's what Rome said, the express purpose of supplanting the Bible with the Code of Justinian. The Code of Justinian became the center point of all. They were called universities because una means unit or unity, and versus means around. Versus is Latin for around. University means that place where there is unity around something. Well, the something that they wanted that unity to be around was the Code of Justinian. Nothing that was taught in any of the disciplines of science, the different colleges of a university, was allowed to contradict in any way the Code of Justinian, because they said the Code of Justinian is perfected human reason. They even said it's the Logos. The Logos, that's what John the Apostle said Jesus Christ is. Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Logos, translated word. And the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. He was in the beginning with him. Logos. Well, that's what Rome said they had. They said, no, the mind of man perfected human reason is the Logos, the code of Justinian. And John the Apostle slapped that idea right square in the face. The first verse, coming right out of the gate of his gospel. Well, the foreign mercenaries to which this paragraph, number 27, refers are the dreaded German Hessians. Now, King George III was the elector of Hanover, Germany. That means he was a German, and he was. The only reason he sat on the throne, this is odd, this is the way it works, so. He was sitting on the throne because the only option they had for a Protestant king, they didn't want a Romanist king. They'd had that before, didn't like that. So he was related enough, they'd put him on the throne. Well, actually, his grandfather and his father and then him, but they just thought they'd keep him. He was, of the three, he was the only one born in England. But he was the Elector of Hanover. He was a German prince. And he wasn't different from them in that they were a Germanic people largely too, but he was German and he was King of Britain. He was also an English prince, and thus the Hessians were from Germany, from Hanover, that he sent to help subdue the American colonies were his subjects, you see. And this is this is the kind of stuff that goes on today. By a cabal of statecraft, watch this, King George III leased the Hessians from himself. He was the lessor who leased the Hessians to himself as King of England. You see, he was, that's called shell game. He was Prince of Germany, so they had to do what he said. And they were under his absolute control in Germany. There was no common law in Germany by that time. So he said, well, I put my hat of German prince on, and I'll lease them to myself. I'll put on my hat being King of England. I'll lease them to myself. That way I can get money from England as King of England, from the taxpayers. I'll get that money and pay over here to Germany, and I'll go over there and put on my German hat, and I'll take the money. That's called a cabal. So he leased the Hessians from himself to himself. And the transaction was not only profitable to him and the banks in which he invested, the Bank of London, they liked it, but it was risk-free. He couldn't lose. As German prince, George demanded a large lease payment for the Hessians. As King of Great Britain, he borrowed that payment from England's central bank and laid the interest payments on the back of the British people, the taxpayer. Then, as a German prince, he received that lease payment for his Hessian soldiers and invested it in Germany's central bank, which owned England's central bank. Ha! Oh, boy. Thus, having enslaved Hessians, he enslaved the British to the bankers through debt. Then he tried to use the Hessians to enslave the colonists to the same cabal of theft. Such shenanigans are common law abhors. Well, this is called self-dealing, of course, in the most intense way, because you're dealing with yourself. You see, as a common law, and the Bible also, by the way, it's impossible as a matter of law to contract with yourself, to make an agreement with yourself. Can you imagine somebody going into court and say, and suing yourself? Can you sue yourself? Can you bring a contract action against yourself? No. Why? Because you can't contract with yourself. It takes two parties to have a reciprocal contract. Now, King George not only cinched the worth of his bank investment on the backs of the British for years to come, but also cinched profits and power for the German-England bankers' cartel. Bottom line, the bankers enslave a people by debt, and their tool is the presumptive silly they call the useful idiot, that enslaving himself to their sham in exchange for false feelings of security. Now, in all that talk and my lisping, stammering tongue trying to explain this cabal, and you might say to yourself, I don't have a clue what he was saying. Don't be too hard on yourself. The reason you might not have a clue what I was saying is because it's utterly senseless. Even if I try to explain it, it's still senseless. And that's what, of course, our central bank in America does today. And the Bank of London in England does the same thing. It's the cabal of the bank loaning money to itself and charging interest and putting the interest burden on the taxpayer. That's what he was doing. But they do it in all sorts of ways, more ways than you would have time trying to understand. That's how they get away with it. The mercenary. What is a mercenary? A mercenary is a combatant hired by, leased from, or lent out to someone other than the mercenary's own government to fight in a foreign war. The civil law of state decrees absolute power over its military draftees, just as King George III asserted absolute power over the young Hessian men to buy, sell, and lease them at his will. And they had to kill or be killed at his command. Well, that's trafficking in the souls of men. That's what the Bible calls it, the book of Revelation, trafficking in the souls of men. Just one way to do it. There are a lot of ways. Bureaucrats even doing favors and paying personal debts with the lives and service of young men. The use of mercenaries, though found in the history of common law countries, has never been a part of our common law tradition. The mercenary fights on command for profit for himself, for his master, or both. If you're enslaved, as were the Hessians, and they probably wouldn't admit it, but they were. And they were fighting for the profit of their master, and for a paycheck for themselves, no doubt, but still the great profit of their master, you see. And by contrast, the non-mercenary fights for his rights and those of his family and his neighbors and his countrymen. And if he receives a dollar or two a day while he does it, he considers himself fortunate. And in the past, the United States has neither employed mercenaries nor has let her sons out as mercenaries. American submission to the will of international organizations in our own day, however, threatens this tradition. Joseph Plum Martin was once a young Continental soldier, and years later, as an old veteran of the American War for Independence from Britain, he recalled his discovery of the unburied remains of Hessian mercenaries a full year after pitched battle against them. He spoke in outrage. He spoke in outrage of the servile condition to which the statist mercenary trade had reduced the poor Hessians. And because Britain's King George III was also a German prince, the Hessians he had sent to subdue England's American colonies were his subjects. J.T. Martin believed he was the Continental soldier. He's writing this as a man over 70 years old. He believed that the use of mercenaries is but the symptom of a greater evil. And what is that greater evil, according to J.P. Martin? He says it's total state power over men, total state power over men. In hindsight of decades past, J.P. Martin recalled his feelings upon discovering the remains of his Hessian foes, providing a good rebuke for Americans yet to come. And I'm going to read from his memoirs of his years of war. He enlisted as a private, got out 7 years later as a sergeant. He is the only enlisted man we have that has written a complete memoir of his service. Listen to what he says upon discovering the remains of Hessian soldiers after the Battle of White Plains, in which he was engaged a year or two later. He says, I, with some of my comrades who were in the Battle of White Plains in the year of 76, one day took a ramble over the ground where we were then engaged with the British. We saw a number of the graves of those who had fell in that battle. Some of the bodies had been so slightly buried that the dogs, or hogs, or both, had dug them out of the ground. Their skulls and other bones and hair were scattered about the place. Here were Hessian skulls as thick as a bombshell, he says. Poor fellows! They were left unburied in a foreign land. They had perhaps as near and dear friends to lament their sad destiny as Americans who laid buried near them. But they should have kept at home. We should never then have gone after them to kill them in their own country. But the reader will say, they were forced to come and be killed here, forced by their rulers who have absolute power of life and death over their subjects. Now listen to his conclusion. Well, then, dear reader, bless a kind providence that has made such a distinction between your condition and theirs. And be careful, too, that you do not allow yourself to be brought to such an abject and servile condition. Well, the abject and servile condition of which J.P. Martin here speaks is that of those subject to rulers who conscript and sell their subjects' lives and military services to a foreign power or under foreign officers. The Hessians fighting Americans were enslaved to George III, not only a German prince, but also King of England. And the lives of the Hessians, they were all, of course, feared for their ruthless prowess in battle. They were good. But their lives were sold to King George of England from Prince George of Germany for money. Such slavery now threatens Americans' armed forces, as our government puts her sons and despicably even her daughters under command of United Nations foreign officers. This clause, clause 27, refers to circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, those were the words he used, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, because king and parliament, unable to subdue the colonies by threats or force, planned instead terrorism as barbarous force, even to the point of infusing the smallpox virus into the colonies through the slave population, an attempt at germ warfare to destroy the population. And General Washington, having learned of this barbarity, I'm not used to saying big words, Washington having learned of this barbarity, and he himself had survived smallpox when he was young, his face was horribly scarred from it, he understood it, but he asked if the Continental Army would submit to smallpox vaccination, knowing full well, him and them both, that likely 10% would die from the vaccination. But without it, the Brits' germ warfare would kill 90% of the Continental Army. That's what they were after. He didn't want them to be killed, of all people, because vaccination disabled each man for about 2 weeks with scabbing and general discomfort. Washington staggered vaccination of the army, group by group, and the colonial soldiers' selfless assent to this dangerous misery bespeaks his loyalty. This has been a constant threat throughout our history, that Americans would be put under command of foreign officers or foreign princes. That's not to be allowed in America. Even when General Pershing landed in France in World War I, of course, the French came to him right away and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take your men, we're going to put them over here, and they're going to take these men of yours and put them over here, and we know what's going on here. We've been here 4 years. We know how to fight this war, so your men will go under our officers and we'll fight. And General Pershing said, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, he said, it's been a policy in my country that we never do that, and we've never done it, and we're not going to start now. As a matter of fact, all of my men will stay under my command, and we will do in 4 months what you fellows have failed to do in 4 years. We'll win the war. That was his goal in 4 months. And he pretty much did that. Of course, it's without debate now that the Americans won the war. The English couldn't do it. The French couldn't do it. But General Pershing, with his men, did it, but he didn't do it by allowing other people to command troops. That's a bad business. If you put foreigners in charge of troops that are foreign to the troops don't have any loyalty to them. It's the way it is. Now you say, well, we had French officers during the American War for Independence over American troops. We had Polish officers. What about General Pulaski? Well, yes, but all of those officers were under His Excellency, as they called him at that time, General George Washington. He said, you come under my command, that's fine. And there were a lot of people in the Continental Army that were from other places, Ireland, Scotland, and England, for three, not to mention Germany, Poland, and a lot of other places, not to mention the tribes of American Indians from South Carolina especially, and North Carolina that came up to join and did. So when I say under foreign officers, I mean under the ultimate command. I served in the military with a lot of foreigners from other countries. They were trying to get citizenship. People from South America and Europe, by the way. That was even more so because there were a lot of immigrants in the American colonies in those days. Well, Gerard, thanks again. These are applicable principles, I do believe. And we need to pay close attention because the fundamental problems, as Fratcher used to say, the fundamental problems of America are perennial. And they were perennial even before America came on the scene. Perennial, that's a big word, it means yearly, annual. They just keep coming up again and again. We have dressed them in modern clothes, different people, but it's the same fundamental problem. And mercenaryism is part of that problem. Back to you, Gerard. If we're not going back to Gerard, I'll keep talking. But when Gerard shows up, I'll stop. I'll go to paragraph 28.
Sometimes it takes him a second.
Okay.
So if you got just a second to talk a little bit,
okay,
and then try him again.
Yeah, I'll just keep talking when he can come, and I'll stop and try him again. Paragraph 28. It says, he, King George III, has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, constrained them to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. Now here, our Declaration of 76 charges King George with common law kidnapping, slavery, and murder at common law. He's taken captive, it says, on the high seas. In those days, they called it impressment. And what the British were doing, and they did this after our independence from Britain also, and that's the biggest excuse, among the biggest excuses for the war of 1812, they were stopping American ships. British warships were stopping American ships on the high seas and at the points of guns and cannons, boarding them and taking however many men they needed for crew members, claiming that they were men that had gone AWOL from their Navy or that they were truly British, they weren't American, they were British subjects and all that kind of stuff, but they didn't have much proof. Well, that's what they were doing here. They were taking them captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country. In other words, they were making seamen out of them. They needed sailors bad. It was hard to find men to sign up for the Navy. And so they just impressed them into service anywhere they could get them. And that's why we have that word called Shanghaiing. It came to be called Shanghaiing in more modern times. John Wayne was in a famous movie where he was Shanghaied. But it was in modern times just before World War I. Shanghai, and probably still goes on around the world. Once you get a guy on board, he can't get off. It's either work or go to the brig. So that's how they get people to serve on their warships. Well, King George's decree of outlawry up in paragraph 25, we talked about, had duty-bound every able-bodied American man to kill any of his friends and family disloyal to George III. If you remember, outlawry is when the powers that be, or at old common law, the jury, declares a man of no more value than a wolf. He won't submit to the process, the due process of the courts, and he's been accused of a crime, therefore he is outlawed. That means he's outside the protection of the law, and any decent man who finds him has two choices under the law. Either kill him and bring his head in for identification, or capture him and bring him in. Of course, if it was easier to kill him, people would do that. Well, that's what King George III had done to Americans. That way, he created among Americans the unenviable dilemma of either obeying the king or becoming the object of your neighbors trying to kill you or capture you. you say, oh, surely that didn't go on. Oh, no, it went on a lot. You can go back and read the accounts of it. About a third of the colonials, or about 3 million people lived here in that day, about a third of them, about a million of them, were loyalists to King George III. About a third of them were loyalists to the United States. And about a third of them didn't care one way or the other, and they'd go either way, depends upon which way the wind was blowing when they were threatened. So that kind of stuff happened. In fact, J.P. Martin tells about the time he was out on patrol, and he saw a fella, and he standing off a ways, and this fella all of a sudden started running toward him. And when he got close to him, he saw that it was a boy he'd gone to school with when he was a little boy. And he hollered at him. And the more he hollered at him, that, hey, this I'm J.P. Remember me? I'm J.P. I went to school with you. Well, the faster he ran, he had his sword drawn, and J.P. didn't have any weapon, and he began to run. And he could see this guy was trying to kill him. And he ran until he thought, well, he was gaining on him. He thought, I'll clamber over these. There had been a tree that had been felled there. I'll clamber over these branches, and I'll get him balled up in the branches, and I'll lose him. Well, he got his foot caught between two limbs that had twisted together. He couldn't get his foot out, and before he could just pull his foot out of his shoe, this fella came back down across his buttocks with his saber, full force, split him wide open, the backs of his legs, just below his buttocks. And I can't remember, I'd have to go back and read the book, how he got out of that scrape. But he got out and got home, and he was laid up for a long time, and they tried to sew him back together, and he finally got back online again. But if he'd hit an artery, that'd have been all over but the crying. But he hit him on the back of the legs and apparently avoided hitting those main arteries that go down through your leg. Well, are you back yet there, Gerard?
Yeah, I'm back. I had to reboot my Skype. Okay, thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, thank you.
Okay, the queue is open, and I'm going to take the first one in it. It's Maria from Wisconsin. Go ahead, you've been unmuted.
The North Town. This would be caused very easily by an earth chip. Earth is sitting now at an angle.
I can't hardly hear you. Can you make it loud? You're like really low.
Well, we have no information about that. The only thing we have is that it would take.
Could that be a show she's watching and she's not paying attention?
Oh, maybe, because I can't make heads or tails out of it. You know what? I thought she was breaking up.
And go to Fred.
Yeah, let's try that, because I don't think she's answering me. That was weird.
Okay. You want me to do it, or you want to do it?
I got Fred unmuted right now.
Hello, Gerard. Hello, guys.
Hey, how's it going, Fred?
You got a paper and pencil to write this stuff down?
Yeah.
Okay. First off, I've got a lot of comments about this case, about the guns. Number one, that lawyer, he hung a lot of names on NOA. I don't like that. So why don't you make him provide legal definitions and reference the book it comes out of?
There you go. I think it starts with a big B and it ends with a T.
I'm not done yet. But anyway... Yeah. Second, I want you to subpoena the judge and the attorney general, get their oath of office, both of them, because they're gonna be swearing to uphold the Constitution. And then I want you to get their bar membership agreement, where it says they'll keep things normal in the courts for the bar, and you got a conflict of interest right there. That should disqualify him. Then you've got the errors and omissions insurance. Get those numbers off those guys. Because you know what? If they become personally liable, then you can use the errors and omissions insurance to wedge between their personal finance and what the insurance is willing to pay. Then you want the exact name that practices law under the bar card. And if the name they're using on their documents is one iota difference, like if it's James Whitmore Blowhard, if he's not practicing law under that exact name in a courtroom, it's fraud upon the court.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to demand the reason for more time that alters the rules of procedure. And lastly,
there is no rule, but go ahead.
Lastly is this. You subpoena from that judge the common law procedures in a court. Now, remember, we are not in a civil court. We're in a common law Article 3 court. So this is going to pin his ass to the ground. And you want the jury present during all court, because the judge is nothing more than a magistrate in this court in a common law proceeding. You got to lay down the law to that boy.
Well, we understand that, and that's the battle too, you know, because look at, when you go into these courts, the game they're playing is they have a cover sheet that you fill out that has check boxes in it.
I am aware of all that.
Right.
I'm aware of all that.
They feel comfortable. No, we put in what we put in, and we said, look at, this is an Article 3 court. We put our memorandums of law in, and if they had any objection, they should have objected the day we put it in, not 6 months later and say, oh, you guys are a group and you need an attorney and such crap. Look at, they just want to throw us out because they can't answer us. They know they can't answer because they know they're outside of the law.
And then panel the jury right out of the gate and tell the judge he's a magistrate.
Well, actually, we did have a magistrate.
Yeah, well, you know, that was on the other case, the one that were the repository.
Right.
Not this one. On this one, you got a judge.
Oh, yeah. And the judges are magistrates, too. They can wear a magistrate hat. That's fine.
Well,
they just can't make decisions.
That takes all their power away.
Right.
And that's what you intend to do, correct?
Absolutely. Well, we've told them that, but it's going to take reinforcement. And at this point, I think by throwing them in the case, they're going to realize that we're not fooling around.
Okay. Well, how many NLA members with the press credentials are in the courtroom taking pictures?
They had a date set for June whatever, but that date is off the table now, right?
Well, you're going to have a hearing over what this attorney filed, and that's when you want all the court reporters you can get.
Oh, yeah, look, you're right. When we got to go there and stand there in front of them, I hope we have an overfilling room for sure.
Yeah.
It's going to be pretty interesting to see what happens.
Everybody that's on that list that lives in that area should be in that courtroom demanding justice. We want a common law courts. What are you doing? You know, to make a scene.
Well, not only that, I think we should get the Gun Owners of America Association, which is spearheaded in New York. They got thousands of members. Our case should go out. They should support us.
They should all be on the docket.
I understand we didn't get them on the docket, but they could still show up. They could still support us.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and I think it would be pretty rude not to let Brent comment on all this because I unloaded a whole bomb.
Well, he could comment anytime he wants to.
I'm going to mute out. Let you guys go for it. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, if that's an invitation, Gerard, I'll say a couple words. Is that an invitation to comment? If you go in a courtroom and make a scene, you probably get arrested and thrown in jail for contempt. It's been my experience. You don't want to, well, you do it. That's what happens. And making a scene against the orders of a judge in the court, and I'm just speaking as a practical matter, this is what would happen, is direct contempt. indirect contempt is bad-mouthing a judge outside of his presence. That's pretty much part of America to do that. But you go in the courtroom, do it to his face, that's quite another matter. And of course, the courts take a dim view of that, and so I'm just reporting what I've seen happen. Take it for what it's worth. I think it would happen, probably. Just to make a comment about that one thing about contempt. I don't want to see anybody thrown in jail without cause. I won't be mouthing off to any judges. I'll try to talk about the law, but I don't think it's appropriate. The Bible says, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. And I believe that's an important part of our common law tradition, so I wouldn't do that. You can tell him the truth. You can make your arguments. You can tell him even he's wrong if you do it respectfully. I've done that before. But you got to do it respectfully. I've done it in different contexts like that. Sometimes I've even asked permission to speak my mind. And if he says yes, then I'll spit it out. Well, he may spit his mind out back at me, but at least we do it respectfully. There's something to learn from the English. I used to like to watch the parliamentarians on C-SPAN. Those fellows over the centuries have developed the art of insulting each other in the most egregious ways, politely. But the English are good at that. Us Americans, we just tell each other off, but there are some places you hadn't ought to do that. Portland's probably one of them. For what it's worth, I wanted to add that, Gerard. Back to you.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, look, we've been to court on various occasions, and we've never been held in contempt because we don't mouth off. But we do say our piece, like you said. And first of all, the judge that did these things, and the prosecutor, the attorney general, assistant attorney general, I don't think they'll still be on the case. I think that's going to be fought on paperwork. I think that they were going to, by the time we get done with the paperwork going back and forth, they'll have to recuse themselves. And I mean, if not, then that's what we will go there demanding, respectfully demanding that they recuse themselves and that, you know, otherwise it's a sham. If we're over there making charges and maybe even taking charges on them and they still think they're going to run the case, then you know what you have. You have a kangaroo court, basically. And, of course, it does no good to open your mouth at that point. You just got to do what they say and then put your paperwork in when it's all over. And we've done that. We've went to court. We've said our piece. And then we filed the paper. We filed the paper when we were done on it. So, but, you know, the main thing for us is, and the judges get very nervous when there's a bunch of people in the courtroom. When you come in and you have 50 or 100 or even 200 people, I've seen that, too. They don't work good in the light. That's being in the light. And you can be very respectful. He's very careful about how he treats you and about what he says, because now he's got the public in there. And if there's one thing a judge is, he is a political animal, and he understands the power of the people. And a matter of fact, I think one of the biggest things that we have done is our court observer program, because that really seems to have the most effect on the judges. You know, they fear the parties first. You know, the parties have control over the judges. They're the ones that you know, put them on the ticket, the ones that get elected anyway. But really, they understand the power of the people. So they're much more careful when there's lots of warm bodies, especially if they got notepads and they're taking notes, your court observers and things like that. So I'm sure we won't do anything to get be held in contempt of, and like you said, you can ask permission to speak, or you say, I do not wish to be held in contempt. You always start the statement with, I do not wish to be held in contempt, because that's evidence that you're not fighting with him. That's a tactic that some lawyers use. You know, I don't wish to be held in contempt. And I don't think by reiterating the Fourth Amendment or this that you can hold me in contempt for that, you know, respectfully. I'm stating that that's part of our right, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, he could get mad at you. At that point, you shut up. We understand that, you know. But he's got to do it in front of whoever's there. That's the thing. And he's got to deny the law in front of whoever's there. Look, they don't want us in court, and chances are, this thing will be fought on paperwork. I don't know if we'll have any public hearings. They won't want any public hearings, and I don't care if we have them or we don't have them. The main thing is that it gets fought out on paper at least, right? I mean, and we've had whole cases fought out on paper like that.
Uh-huh.
So well, that's what we're going for.
I was going to make a comment about how to talk to the judge, because you brought up some ideas, and that those were good. I'm reminded of that passage in the book of Genesis when Abraham goes to pray to God to appeal to him as the supreme judge of all the world, to appeal to him to not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And I would recommend it to any of your reading. I think he would be fascinated how Abraham approaches the maker of heaven and earth in beseeching him as a judge and how respectful he is. You say, well, but these judges aren't maker of heaven and earth. I know. But the principles that he uses here in persuasion, persuading God himself and how he goes about it are worthy of reading. And I think that these principles that you see here in this passage would apply to any time you'd ever try to persuade anybody. But one thing for sure that is often forgotten by those that don't go into court a lot, and understandably so, but judges are men. And not only are they men, they're men that are under a lot of pressure. No matter how good or bad they may be otherwise, they're still under a lot of pressure. I mean, if they're not under pressure to do the right thing, they're under pressure to do the wrong thing. Maybe they received a bribe, and they're afraid for their lives. Maybe they're afraid in a tax case that the IRS will audit them if they don't do certain things. I mean, they're just men. That's what I'm driving at. And I know this. It's a lot easier to do things for people that come to me and try to persuade me and are nice to me than somebody that comes and demands. I bristle up real quick. Why? Well, because I'm a man. And men at their best are still only men at best. And that's not saying much. And I bristle, and I may just say no just because I don't want to be pushed. And I think all men are that way to varying degrees. Now, I don't know. I don't have a clue. I don't understand female species that much. So I'll let somebody else who thinks they understand how to do that talk about it. And I've got five daughters, and my mothers, and my mother-in-law, and I've got all sorts of gals around me, and I don't understand them yet. Maybe it's supposed to be that way. That makes them fascinating to me. But on the other hand, it's just with men, I'll speak to that question. I do know that it's better to come in with a little bit of tact, have a plan, try to follow it. That's what Abraham does back here in Genesis. I believe it's around chapter 19 along in there. Somebody can help me. Maybe they know. If I find it here, I'm going to read it, because I think it makes a good point, but I'm not coming up with it just real quick here. But at any rate, if I come up with it later, Gerard, I'll
supplement something you said, Brent.
Okay.
You know, you talk about respecting the judge and that, you know, look, uh-huh. authority comes and goes, and authority depends on what seat you're sitting in. You know, if you're elected to a position, like let's say mayor of a city, uh-huh. when you speak something from the chair that you're sitting in under the guise of being mayor, it means something, right? You have the authority. When a lot of times those things become law that you say from that chair, right? So you have authority by virtue of the position. But you see, once you leave that chair, once you leave that office, you can say the same things, and they don't mean the same thing, because you're not sitting in that seat of authority. And that's where the judge is. He's sitting in a seat of authority, and that's why they command a certain amount of respect, because that's the order of the court. And he has that authority. He has the authority to loose or bind. I mean, that's part of his discretion. And so, yes, when you come in front of him, they expect you to recognize their authority. And where, you know, of course today mm-hmm. they got a bigger opinion. They are sovereign in a certain sense, but we're more sovereign than they are. The sovereignty they have is eclipse sovereignty. The people mm-hmm. Actually have a bigger sovereignty than them judges do. And that's what they mm-hmm. forgot. They've forgotten that when in doubt, you got to rule for the people. If there's a problem between a statute and the Constitution or the people, The people get the benefit of the doubt, not the statute. These are the things that they forgot. And I mean,
yeah,
how do you go and school the judge on that? You know, you can do that, but you got to be very tactful about it. You know.
Yes, and he wants to be taught. I mean, if there's something that he doesn't know, that's what the arguer is there for, to give him more case law, give him more reason to do what you're asking. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want a case against a big credit card company, you know, a big one like Citibank or one of them, or Chase, I don't remember what it was, but, you know, I went, it was 3 or 4 years old. And then when we finally got into court and we went back and forth and back and forth, and we had all these hearings in the back room with the judge and the bank's attorneys or the credit card's attorney, and I was fighting with them. And at the end of the day, they didn't give me what I wanted. They never delivered the things that I asked for, and they stalled. And then it was going to go to trial because the judge was doing everything within his power to get us to settle. And I even agree. I said, look, I don't agree with this. It's not my, I don't know what they're doing here. I don't understand it. I said, but I'll tell you what, you know, they always come out with an offer. Their main thing is to settle the scales. That's what they want to do. And they'd rather not do it at a trial if they can help it. I got that message really quickly in there. So you go back and forth, and so they made me an offer, and I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll pay. They said we'll take half. I said, I'll tell you what, take half of the half, a quarter, and we'll call it a day. And I'm not admitting any wrong. I'm just saying I need to get out of here. We've been back and forth here for 2 years. It's costing me money. They wouldn't do it, and the judge got very upset at that. He thought that it was ridiculous, but they hadn't answered some of the things that I called for. I wanted proof. I said, show me, you know, show me that contract that you claim that I have with you.
Yeah.
And you know, because they do all kinds of things in their benefit. They'll send checks out and they say, well, if you sign this check, you agree to the terms and conditions on the back, but they won't produce the terms and conditions when push comes to shove to prove that you signed that check. You know what I mean?
Right. Uh-huh.
But anyway, as we went back and forth and eventually it was time to go to trial, right? Because we couldn't come to an agreement. And so they claimed that they had a witness that had firsthand knowledge, and the judge was very surprised with that because he was like, you know, I'm sure he thought, if you had this witness, why didn't you bring him home? Why didn't you bring him forth sooner, you know? So the day that it came to do the trial, there was no witness there. They hadn't made any kind of a arrangement to have somebody testify over the phone. And the attorney for the other side, I got to know her because she was in there a couple times, and we chatted out in the hall back and forth, and I got kind of friendly with her. And she told me, she said, you're going to win this thing because they didn't send a witness. I mean, these were attorneys, local attorneys that they called up at the last minute and had them show up in court with some piece of paper they faxed them that really didn't know much about anything of the case, but they were like getting paid to carry, you know, Citibank through the court. So anyway, long story short, she said, well, I got this paper. And he said, did they send any other settlement? They said, no. But what they said is if you dismiss the case, that you would do it without prejudice. So in other words, they could come back, I guess, right? Without prejudice. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You want it with. And he said, the judge said, now, why would I do that? You see, I think there's an unwritten rule that the judges should never fine for the people, always for the banks. But what happened I even wrote a paper that John let me put in. We were working together on this thing. And I said, the problem with these people is they think the Citibank, the too big to fail bank, they think that they have the whole world in their back pocket, me and this court, and even you, Your Honor. And I shouldn't have put that paper in, but I did. I was pissed, you know, and I wrote it. And so I apologized to him because I realized he was reading it one day when I got there. They don't look at nothing until the day of, you know. And I started making excuses. I said, look, I was upset, you know, because they didn't take my order. And then I felt like that they want me to accept this so that they can say that it's, yeah, look, at he's acknowledging it's his bill, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, he ruled for me. With prejudice, he said, look, He said, we've been going back and forth for months here. You guys haven't produced anything. And Mr. Apria has brought all kinds of motions, all kinds of stuff. He says, I'm gonna rule with prejudice on his behalf. So because he got a schooling. He never saw anybody with paperwork like what I put in. And they sent a lot of paperwork, but it didn't mean anything. Like they would send in all kinds of stuff. I said, Your Honor, they could have got this paperwork from dumpster diving. This doesn't prove anything. I think he was really impressed that we put such a good fight up, and they were, and half the time even their paperwork was so sloppy,
They get bored watching the same old stuff. Get somebody like you come in and don't really know, you don't know the system, so you don't know how to follow the unwritten rules, and it's kind of refreshing. But it brought to mind, I was in court not very long ago, and the judge, every time he'd say something, he'd run himself down like he didn't know anything. He was stupid. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not much. Well, finally I said, and I thought it was appropriate and that he wouldn't get upset about it, I said, Judge, you talking that way about yourself isn't giving us a whole lot of confidence in your ability to handle this case. So I don't believe what you're saying is true. I think you're down on yourself for no good reason. And I said, don't say that anymore. I was trying to encourage him a little bit. And he did say it some more, but he was just demeaning himself for no good reason. But in any case, in your case, Gerard, if you'd have blown your stack at him at some point, that might not have happened, what I'm thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you're right, don't ruin it by blowing your stack, in the courtroom.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. Let me just see if we can get the next one up here if we're done here. I'm going to go for my glasses here. It looks like Andy, a VoIP dialer.
Andy or Cindy?
Oh. It says Andy, but maybe it's Cindy.
No, okay. I guess I'm talking to
if
you.
If you're Cindy, I'll go with Cindy.
Okay, I'm Cindy. You hear me, then it must be me.
It must be you.
Okay. Well, I was hoping actually Crystal might be on before me. I wanted to know.
She's not in the queue, but go ahead.
No, I just wanted to know if she was experienced, because I've been listening to her plight. I wonder if she was experiencing a pooling and servicing scam. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, she had one of those loans that came under the scrutiny that they were supposed to fix. Somebody's feeding back here. A hard time here. I'm hearing myself. But I don't know if it was servicing and pooling. I know they were doing robo-signing and stuff like that with her. I don't know if it was servicing and pooling, though. And it probably was, because they made some new loan that she never signed or she never had. So is that what that servicing and pooling scheme is?
Oh my goodness, it is terrible, and I'm in the middle of it. And I've been researching this stuff for a while, trying to understand this mortgage fraud and all of this. And my goodness, without even knowing, I have a long story, but I didn't really want to get into it here. I just wanted to ask, and then actually I did want to, maybe I'll email John, but I wanted to ask Crystal if that's what she was experiencing. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. I thought I got lost.
No.
It's
Well, whatever's going on, she's not the only one over there in Connecticut, because they got a bunch of people, and they were investigating the lawyers that are foreclosing on these properties. And I think that's what they're doing. I think they found this scam, and they all got together, and it was a nice little game. And most people don't know what's going on, and we are sheeple. They know we're sheeple, and so they feel like they can. And especially, you know, Crystal is getting up there in age, and so they feel like she's not such a big threat. Boy, did they poke the wrong bee's nest when they poked her. You know what I mean? God bless her. She's given them a heck of a fight so far, you know? So I hope she gets up there.
Kind of like where I am now, because I've been sitting on my house and a problem for almost 8 years now. I mean, I have them by statute of limitations, okay? I've done nothing.
Right.
I've never asked them, never, nothing. Just sat here, and they kept sending me stuff. So, you know, one of my kids opened something, so now it was bankruptcy, okay? So once I met with them, I figured, all right, it's time. You know, it's been a long time. I've been playing chess a little bit, you know, but because I know what's out there. I know I've been listening to you guys. I've learned a lot from you guys, you know, but I mean, what really turned me on to you guys was when I saw the name Prudenti, because I went through probate court almost 28 years ago, and she was the judge, and that was my first introduction of American justice. Okay. And I'm just one of those. Yeah, they poked the wrong bee's nest here too. I may go down, but I'm gonna expose, you know, what I know. And now I'm in the middle of the bankruptcy case, but I'm stopping it, and I'm with the information that I know as far as MERS. You know, the courts have ruled that, and that MERS is not even a legitimate, you know, they can't claim anything, whatever. It's fraud, actually. I mean, anyway, I really wanted to. I'm in Central Suffolk here.
I'll guarantee you just about that it's the same scam that you have. They don't change their MO much from place to place. They found something that they made work, or they think works, and they all do the same thing. And I don't think it matters if you're in a judicial or a non-judicial state. They just roll that thing forward, and that's what they do. And so, you know, they've come up with a couple new tactics. You got to be careful, because sometimes the judge will make some kind of an order for you to do something, and then if you don't do it, then he can hold you in contempt, and the next thing you know, you're getting hauled off to jail because you didn't follow some stupid order he made. You know, so you have to be real careful about that. That's the one thing I've seen them do, you know, when they really, really want to get somebody out of the house so that they can come in and lock it down. So just beware, you know, be careful that he doesn't make some kind of an order and that you don't respond to, or you don't, you know what I mean? Or you don't do, so that it gives him an opportunity to hold you in contempt.
No, well, I haven't been before any judges or anything, because this, when you're in the this pooling and servicing and securitization is what it is, that securitization crap, it's like, this is what I've, you know, you go through bankruptcy, okay, they want to bring, they railroad you, you know, you get all these notices in the mail, okay, because, you know, they want to help you, and then, you know, you get to the bankruptcy lawyer, and you give them what you got as far as, you know, you have a defense, but they don't want to hear any of your defenses. They just want to say, listen, bankruptcy, you got to file for bankruptcy, that'll stop everything, and then blah, 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 and then 6 months later, they can come right back after you. So I don't know who they're helping. You know, so these bankruptcy lawyers, I think they are the ones for the banks in this securitization scam. You know, and because they're allowed to come after you. Everybody who's got a piece of your mortgage pie is allowed to come after you, apparently. And Steve, the judges, nobody understands it. I don't know why nobody understands it. I understand it now. All you have to do is listen to lots of people on the subject. I've listened to mortgage brokers, you know, who, I mean, and it's very understandable. And you can see exactly where it is. And while I was at the bankruptcy office, I'm like, holy crap, I recognize all the language. I'm going to before the trustee, and all the language is that pooling and servicing agreement, and it's fraud. It's total
it's RICO on steroids. they're all in on it, and they're doing it over and over again. So it's RICO. It's organized crime is what it is. You know, it's theft.
This is what I learned when I was at the bankruptcy office, and I had both of my children were there at one time or the other, and they were a little taken aback by the fact that they didn't care about the statute of limitations. We were well within that. I mean, you know, I had a defense. That's a defense. Actually, the people who started the foreclosure, none of the paperwork is original. It looks like they pieced together whatever they could. it's just so. But I recognized the language as to where I am. Once I was in the bankruptcy and the trustee and all of that, and I said, I'm in the middle of what I've been learning about, what I've been researching. I'm right in the middle of it. I'm right in the middle of it. They don't want to hear anything. They want you to. And he's got a stack. This is what they do. It's robo-signing, like you said, and they got a stack of people in bankruptcy, and they're thriving, and they're thrilled. And I said, you don't care that so many people are in bankruptcy? Oh, no, good for us. Oh, no, it's good for us. I was like, this is America. This is sickening. And so that's why I'm going to stop it, because now I feel I'm a victim of MERS. And this whole fraudulent, you know, idea that they're helping you. They're not helping you. They're helping the banks. And the reaffirming of the debt and all of that, that's because they have no original paperwork. They have nothing. So this bankruptcy is a way to get all your paperwork that they don't have. And then you reaffirm the debt, which means they don't own it, but now they do. That's what I get out of all of this. And I was wondering if Crystal.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. But I'll be talking to her probably in this coming week. She called me. I got to call her back. I got a message from her, and I didn't get back to her, so I don't know what's going on right at this point. Anyway, I was hoping to hear from her tonight, but I didn't. And I'm going to move on now because we've got a couple other people in the queue here. But I, you know what? She went through MERS. I know she went. I wasn't privy to all her paperwork. I sent it on to Jim. But they're pulling the same thing with her. They're pulling with you. Exactly that stuff. It's all the same language. You're absolutely right. Now, I don't know if they got some kind of. You know, look at they may be tweaking the scam a little bit here or there, but not too much, believe me, because those lawyers, they know what they know, and that's all they know. You know, so they think they got a pretty good deal and they got it figured out, and they don't change much from person to person. You know what I mean? Matter of fact, I don't even know that the lawyers are thinking this up. This is a process that was worked out by the banks and the lawyers to steal properties, and I think the lawyers just go through the loops. You know what I mean? They go through the steps that they've been told that you do. And I don't think that, you know, that's why a lot of times, you know, when they're doing this stuff, John always says, you know, take them into federal court for violating your fundamental, you know, due process. They're always violating your due process every step of the way. And that was Scalia's big thing. He said, look at the people have due process violations. Look, everything they do to us is a due process violation. So if you know how to write a good federal case and stick to the subject, and you can't talk about all the other nasty stuff that happens in the case, the only thing you can talk about at that point is how they violated your due process, your unalienable right, whatever it is, whether it was due process or one of the other ones. If you give them an opportunity to start talking about other things, which they're not supposed to even consider any of the rest of the case, you're going in there because they didn't follow the rule of law when it came to your due process. And don't let them talk about anything else that happened, and you don't talk about it, and that's how you'll get through that, because they're blatantly and obviously violating your rights. So, you know, at some point you're going to want to end up in the federal court with it, because it's really the other court's not going to give you remedy. They're just not. Anyway, that being said, I'm going to go to the next one. It's good talking to you, and we'll find out what's going on with Crystal here, hopefully. Okay?
Okay. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay. Is this Terry from
New Jersey?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you good. I was just looking over the paperwork that you filed, and I noticed it interesting, too, because Lydia has a similar case, or not similar case, but a similar issue regarding, now this was actually the letter from the Office of the Attorney General, and it says here, I represent, I'm going to skip that one. I intend to make a fully dispositive motion to dismiss on jurisdictional and various other grounds by this new deadline. Now, this is addressed to a magistrate judge, John Stewart. Well, what we found out in Lydia's case is that magistrate judges do not have jurisdiction to rule on dispositive motions. I don't know if you knew that, but I just want to bring that to your attention. I don't know if that ship has sailed. This letter is from February 16th.
Are you talking about the gun case or the other case?
Yeah, well, yeah, Daniel Stewart is the one who's presiding over the gun case, right?
Well, let me see here. I'm confused. No, I don't think so.
Grand jury,
think Daniel...
Well, I'm not sure. I might be confusing them. Grand jury
yeah,
sovereigns of the court versus U.S. Congress at all, Northern District of New York.
Hang on. I lost my page where I had them. Hang on, let me... bring up that page again. You know, I should know, but it's.
Well, I'm a little confused by your numbering too.
Yeah, I think you're on. I think you're on the. I don't think you're on the Second Amendment case. I think you're on the master case one, which is similar but different. You know. Let's see.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Actually, this is from last year. I just noticed. February 16th, 2017.
Right.
Well, in any case, so a magistrate judge doesn't have jurisdiction to rule on dispositive case motions. So that's one of the things I wanted to mention. Also, since we talked a couple of weeks ago, in New Jersey, what the new socialist government has done here is he's formed a panel of former judges, which is composed mostly of former Supreme Court and appellate court judges to vet judicial nominees. I'm not sure about the constitutionality of any of this, and I don't think he cares either one way or the other. And, of course, the judges wants this because they want to be able to vet their fellow criminals before they put them in that position to see if they're dirty enough. So what I did was I took, and the head of this committee is former Supreme Court Justice James Zalley, and so I took his name and I took all the other judges that are on this panel that have been have their fingerprints on my case, because you know, this is going back, you know, almost 18 years now with regard to my unlawful conviction as removal of as executor. Now, all of these judges at one point or another had their fingerprints on my case because I kept appealing this to the higher courts. Eventually, I filed a complaint in federal court against them, which was dismissed. So I took their names, and I took like jamesazali.blogspot.com. Then I took virginialong.blogspot.com. And now, in case of Virginia Long, now this is what they do: is they take these corrupt judges and they put them in these positions. Like Virginia, when they retire, like Virginia Long eventually was forced to retire because you have to retire as a judge at age 70 in New Jersey, and she goes on to the gets appointed as the board of trustee of. The name escaped me now, but an organization that's very active in overturning wrongful convictions and stuff like that. So he basically had this judge who ignored my case, okay, because for whatever reason. Well, actually, I know what the reason was, because they were protecting corrupt lower court judges, and they were blatant in what they did, you know, as far as removing me as co-executor and arranging my conviction so that they could put in a corrupt Bergen County Bar Association president, okay, who took over the estate and basically milked it. So, what I noticed here is that Zazali was also a former attorney general back in 1981 when they came out with these rules for the prosecutors. So I'm looking at these rules for the prosecutor, and one of the things that rule is for the prosecutor to invite the person who is being indicted to appear before the grand jury. Now, that never happened in my case, and I'll bet you dollars a donut that pretty much happens in every case, is that they take these complaints, they don't bother to call the alleged defendant to appear before the grand jury, and the grand jury court just rubber stamps them because they don't understand what their job is, and that's basically what happened. So what I'm doing is I'm doing this blog now, and I'm putting everything in there about how five of these seven nominees for the judicial nomination committee are involved in covering up a criminal conspiracy. So that's about all I had to say. I just wanted to bring to your attention.
You know, Terry, it's funny because I ran across this today, and I was going through my bookmarks on my computer, and I've got all kinds of stuff bookmarked, thousands of them. But a couple of years ago, I ran across the case, and this was down in New York City. And it was a lesson on the grand jury, and they were working out of Harlem or something in that area. It was an area with a lot of Afro Americans in it, and it was a black woman commentator. She was a former judge, I believe, and she wanted to go back into the, where, you know, she had a little local TV show, and she was showing people what goes on in the courts. So she had the grand jury foreman, some black man that had been a jury foreman on three separate occasions, and so he understood how the grand jury worked. And they had a prosecuting attorney, this woman, who had been a prosecuting attorney for over 30 years. And they're sitting there talking back and forth about what's going on in the courts and the grand jury system. And this guy, I'll never forget, his name was Boykin. And he said, well, we get the evidence, the prosecutor gives us this or that. And then I asked for the defendant package. And the lady, this woman, she says, what? You asked for a defendant packet information? He said, yes, every time I asked for the defendant packets. She said, I have to shove it in under the door practically. She says, they don't want them. This is exactly what you're talking about. This is the defendant or the defendant's lawyer's opportunity to speak in front of the grand jury or to lay his case forward in front of it. And she's saying, that they don't take it and they don't do it in the normal course. And he's going, they have to do it. So there's a difference between who it is, what community you're in. You know what I mean? Now, this guy, Boykin, he says he asks for, when he's a jury foreman, he asks for them every time. So not every jury foreman might be educated, or the prosecutor, whoever's telling them what they're supposed to do is not telling them the right thing. You know what I mean? They're not educating them on what their job is. But I could send you that tape. It was very interesting. They went back and forth. And basically, it was in that whole tape. With that woman who was a former judge and the longtime prosecutor and this fellow who had been on the grand jury foreman three times, basically that whole conversation, whatever it was, it's 45 minutes long, was an indictment of the grand jury system in New York State, you know, which is probably not any different than the grand jury system in New Jersey as far as that goes, you know what I mean? So maybe I'll send you that. That might help you also, you know, going through that. You might want to mention some of that stuff in your case.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it because I'm just wondering if this happened in my case where they're supposed to extend an invitation to the defendant and they don't do it, then I think probably, I don't know if it, I find it hard to believe that this just happened in my case. This is probably par for the course. And it leads me to believe that probably most of these indictments and convictions are tainted because the grand jury, rather the prosecutor, did not follow his own book.
Exactly. And look at here, this tape I have absolutely proves, according to that trial attorney, that they don't want to take those, that she has to force them to bring her defendant's case in front of the grand jury to answer the charges, you know? So I'm sure it's epidemic. I think you're right. So I'll see if I can find that. I don't know if I have, I got your phone number. I'll call you maybe, because I don't know if I have an email for you, or maybe you got one. I'll get it from Jan, and I'll send you that, right? Because I think you'll enjoy it. I think it's probably fits right up your alley what you're doing, okay?
All right, thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay. Okay, we got a number here. It starts with 617, no name, no state. You've been unmuted.
Hi. I was listening to Cindy earlier about MERS, or MERS.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Hi, I'm Cynthia from Massachusetts.
Okay.
I've been in and out with in L.A., and I've been trying to track down John's telephone number because I used to talk to him in the past. There's a bunch of us that really did a lot of digging over the years and this whole MERS. And what we discovered was just so evil. Behind that, along with some entities such as like Fannie Mae standard application form,
yeah,
is a patented software program. It's a smart intelligence program and
mm-hmm.
an outcome management tool. This is really informational for people who are wondering, like, well, how did I get in this situation? I lost my job. I lost, you know, getting arrested, you know, all these weird things happening in your life. A lot of it is this MERS, which is actually a trademark entity filed in the patent office that they don't disclose to you. And it infiltrates all the other computer systems. It's like gambling. That's what they, you know, it went on Wall Street. It's under like the Tontine, which is like a gambling insurance phenomena, you know. Schedule that you'll just lose. I mean, the outcome is you're going to lose your house. You're going to lose everything. You're going to file bankruptcy. And bankruptcy puts you in an even worse situation. you know, because there's an implication that you're surrendering your property, not only your real property, but your personal property. And so, and this has come, like, I mean, you know, you'll never learn this stuff because you end up in these crazy summary process courts. In my situation and many others, what these power of attorneys are doing, they're taking over possession of, in essence, you, in a way, and they're filing all these documents to give an appearance of compliance with the state laws. But they're all bogus, you know, these things that they're filing. It's all electronic. It's all,
It's all
under the software program.
Yeah, the robo-signing and everything, but yet it's, you know, they supposedly, they had a big revelation, but they're still doing it. They're doing it with a vengeance out here.
Right. Well, it's taken, years. I mean, who would ever know that these people or these entities, these attorneys, these, you know, CEOs will come up with these concoctions? But it's taken a bunch of people, really smart people, and I love to, you know, I wanted to, like, reach out to, because obviously, I mean, when you're scheduled to lose your home, it's like actually an investment contract, and it's not even really attached to real property, you know, some of these things that we're signing at the, it's deceptive right on its face on day one. But it's taken, like, years and years for, you know, regular people like you and I to, you know, dig around to try to figure out what happened, how it happened. So I'd love to, like, at some point connect with you or John to share, like, what I've found. I'm not sure where to go from here because it's totally, like, not only deprivation of you know, your rights, It's a violation of your right to self-determination, you know, the basic principles of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. You know, if you're scheduled to lose your home and lose your livelihood on a certain date because that's how the program is set up, I mean, obviously you can't really, you know, you have no control over these things.
So in other words, they're not taking into consideration you answering anything under due process. They say, okay, we'll start here. We put this paper in. We do this. We do that. We wait a week.
Right.
We do this. We do that.
Right.
So
right.
You're not able to stop the process by challenging part of one of the moves they're making, and that's you know,
that's kind of like what they do with
the tax foreclosures. They like to do it in REM because you don't really get a chance to respond to anything. It just kind of moves forward. It's an abandoned ship at sea type thing.
Right.
You're not asking your permission. They're just going ahead and, like, you abandon it, so to speak.
Well, the state, I mean, you know, they have this assumption that, you know, through power of sale and you know, these righteous attorneys and things like that, that they're doing the right thing in order to foreclose, in order to do, like, a summary process to, you know, take possession of your property. So there's an assumption that they did all, you know, did everything properly. And so, I mean, just the whole thing is not even go there with the summary process.
Just the fact that they could take your personal, your property under any kind of summary action is kind of important to due process.
Right.
They're just going to bang the gavel and that's it. It's done.
Oh, right, because it's not even common law. I mean, it's lawlessness, basically, you know, because it's, you know, the powers that, it's commercial law. You're in the total wrong jurisdiction in retrospect, you know. But you don't know that when you're going through all of this. I mean, it just takes a lot of research and a lot of years and just discovering really what this MERS monster is. And, you know, it's like hiding in plain sight. When you look at the meaning what of Mers means, and you know, in Latin and French, it means the sea. You know, so that, I mean, they're telling you right there what they're doing. You know, it's a whole gambling software program, and if they want your house, they'll get it, basically. So
right.
I just wanted to share that.
Interesting.
Really,
yeah, you could. You know what? I'll forward that to John as far as
yes.
You know, look.
Oh, I love you guys. I mean, I had to go off and do all this other research and stuff because I was just getting hit from every side and stuff. But
nobody could do it all because they also when people start finding out remedies, then they change mm-hmm. their tactics. That's what's happened through the years. You know what I mean?
Right.
They always figure out because it's statutes, and so they'll statutory. If you figure out how to go through one hole, they'll plug that hole, and they'll, and fix it so that it's not there anymore. If we could get these courts and these judges back to the rule of law, this problem would all go away. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we're kind of hacking at the trunk of the tree here.
Right.
I'm
just so exhausted with the whole legal process. Yeah. I'm not even going there right now because I get nervous even going near a courthouse after what they put me through.
It's what you're doing, and it's mm-hmm. also the probate courts, and they're stealing. The elderly's money, and they're stealing it from families. And then if you get families that are fighting, that's even worse because they pit you against each other and the lawyers get together. And if they can get somebody cooperate to break the law, they really go to town then. If they get one of your family members against you, forget about it. You're done. You're
right. Stuck. Well, that's what happened to me. I was caught up in, I was entrapped, put it that way, in probate. Court family probate and I put all the documents together. I have like 10 big old notebooks. I don't know what to do with it. I'm just trusting God. But interestingly, the day I lost custody of my son was the same day that funds transferred in my 401k to a different company, so I'm putting this all together. It's like, oh my God, this stuff is evil. What's going on? It's all computer stuff.
Even some of the stuff that we were doing, we didn't even understand the full implications of what we were fighting. When we were fighting for the Hammonds and the Bundys, we didn't know that Hillary Clinton had Uranium-1 going on, and that was the reason they were over there.
Yeah.
We had no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't matter. Yeah. Look,
you just know it's wrong.
Not even knowing that.
Right, right. You just know you're doing the right thing.
Well, we knew that she was implicated. We knew that she was complicit in it. We didn't know all the details, but, the nice thing about the grand jury is they don't have to know all the details. That's where it gets fleshed out in court. The fact of the matter is you got A plus B, and generally that equals C. You know what I mean? And so that's what the grand jury's job is.
Right.
So, we've been sort of proven right, where future proves past, because, all these other revelations are basically showing that we were right, and that's why we were in there, because of what they were doing. Very interesting. Look, you should write a book. Put it out there.
I don't know. I got to do something with it. I mean, I'm leaving it in the hands of God right now. I can't even go into a court. I don't want to sit there and try to tell I need to deal with real law, not this stuff, when you walk in there.
Yeah.
So I don't have the energy for that. I'm not insulted that I was used that way to enrich somebody else, so I don't know. I'm praying about it, but you guys are awesome, and I learned so much from you. And when the real laws come back, I think I'll be on a good footing, thanks to you all.
Right. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, God, good luck and God bless.
I look forward to it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and I will. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Felicia, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear. How are you guys doing?
Good. How's it going, Felicia?
It's a roller coaster. I have a couple of questions. I want to know if you guys heard about the case in Florida where I think it was Wells Fargo tried to foreclose on someone, and they ended up having to dismiss it. It was some new guy that's running for state attorney. And the second question is, what do you guys think about Trump rolling back the Dodd-Frank to pretty much give the stock market more leniency? And three, is Judge Cohen, has he been indicted yet?
Has who been indicted yet?
Judge Kahn.
Well, I believe we did it. We did indict him. Hang on a minute here. We got the next paper on Kahn. I forget what John said. I get confused with all these cases we got going on here. Let's see here. Wait a minute. Just bear with me a minute. Let me see if I can, on the gun case.
Because I don't like going through my neighborhood and seeing somebody living in my house.
Oh, I know. That's terrible.
Yeah, I don't like that at all. And honestly, I think it's a police officer from the sheriff's office that's living in it.
Yeah, that was probably one of the conflicts of interest that you didn't even know you had, right?
Yeah.
Hang on, let me get on this docket and see what we did with Kahn. Lawrence Kahn. Papers file. Let me see. I'm pretty sure we did judicial notice. Indictment of Judge Kahn was on October 24th. We filed an indictment on him, which he didn't answer, by the way. I mean, you know, it's something that they're supposed to at least answer. We got him on concealment and felony rescue. And the good thing about this is they are putting it. It is on the docket, as far as I know. Even though the judge said, "Well, you're a bunch of people you need to hire," and we told him, "No, we don't." You know, we're the grand jury coming in now. You know, and he didn't answer that, but he said, "Well, it automatically dismisses in 30 days," and basically, that's what he did. But in the meantime, we filed, let me see here, I could tell you, probably, since he did that, we filed like 4-5 papers, and they're on the docket. So the clerk and the judge are at logger jams with this. So, and the judge wrote a letter after we filed the first one. "I told you that this case is dismissed, not to file any more stuff in it." And we turned around and filed the next one. And apparently the clerk is still putting them on the docket because the judge really had no authority to take them off in the first place. And we sent them, you know, the failure to file paperwork that says, you know, if you remove the paperwork out of the court, if it's the judge, it's 20 years, and if it's the clerk, it's 3 years. And I can imagine that the clerk must have had a little argument with the judge saying, "I'm not going to pull them out. You pull them out if you want to pull them out." So, you know, the case is, everybody thinks it's in limbo because it says dismissed. But meanwhile, if you look at the dismissal date and you look at the papers we're filing, they're still taking them. Look at that case that we're talking about with Judge Kahn. That was really not a case that we expected them to answer. That was us getting into the court as the grand jury because we have to operate under the auspices of the court. So basically, it was a repository for us to put all our stuff in on all these cases, to put them on record, to be considered for indictment at some point. But there really was nothing for them to answer. I don't think they completely understood what we were doing, I mean, they might now. Obviously, they're getting an education, too, because they haven't seen anything like this before. They're not used to the people fighting them with common law. You know what I mean? So sometimes they do things they're a little confused because they won't sit down and read. If they read our paperwork and if they read the footnotes, a fourth grader could figure this stuff out the way we write it. There's nothing legalese or anything about the paperwork we're putting in. I mean, sometimes I got to scratch my head on the paperwork that they put in, but nevertheless, you know, they get lazy and they get silly and so they make mistakes. But right now, I think we're in a pretty good position because I forget what John said the next step we were going to take as far as we were discussing what strategy we were going to do to move this forward. But in the meantime, you know, we're hoping, you know, we got seven new district court judges that Trump sent down here and a new prosecutor and a marshal. So it looks like he's trying to straighten out the New York courts first, which is good for us. I mean, it gives me hope anyway that maybe we'll actually get somebody that follow the rule of law. So hopefully, you know, and look at anything we win up here like this is going to help even you because it's all the same cases, Felicia. They're doing the same thing everywhere. New Jersey, it doesn't matter. New York, they all got the same.
Well, the position I'm in, I really don't like it. I'm homeless, and I don't like right by my house saying somebody's living in it. Knowing that, you know, what they put me through and kicked me out of the house, I don't like it at all.
Yeah, I wonder if there's something you can file to the new home to restate your claim and kind of push him back. We'll have to discuss that.
Well, the new deeds that they have, that Fannie Mae transferred to them, at the bottom of it, somebody whited out the name. It's like nobody really signed it.
Yeah, so it's fraud.
Yeah, I know it is. Nobody really signed it. Because there's no signature. You know how they have a line with the name at the bottom, and you can tell that it was whited out. So, you know, I'm not trying to sit back. I'm not the type of person to sit back. I'm the type of person that likes to take action. You know, I'm homeless. I'm sleeping in my car.
Did you try to get it filed in a federal court? Did you try? I think you were talking to John about that, weren't you?
Yeah, I don't know how to do all that. I'm still learning all this stuff on the website. And I have my phone and I have to go to the library and they limit your time on that. I finally finished one of my other courses.
Did you send any of that paperwork to Jim or John that they gave you, this latest stuff that when they reassigned the deed?
No, sir.
Were we able to get a copy of that?
No, sir, but I can definitely send it to you. Because I had a copy. I got a copy, and I had to pay for it. I had to pay for a copy.
Yeah, but you must have copies of stuff they gave you, though. I mean, can you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, well, I think you should send those copies to Jim or Jan because I want to get them in John's hand. I want to discuss what you said tonight about what they did. Learned a couple things tonight with this MERS because maybe we can get some ideas on how to proceed. And maybe I don't know for sure. Don't take me, you know, I'm just putting things out there trying to get things together. But maybe there's something we can do as the grand jury, since this thing is it's multiple states wide, and they kind of seem to be doing the same thing. So maybe that's a case that we could run through the court, the federal court, for you as one of the plaintiffs. I don't know. I don't think you're going to get any relief from the state court. I don't think they care.
They don't. Trust me, I know.
No.
They don't, because I went to the sheriff before I was even kicked out and showed him the documents, and they put me in a room, and I'm looking at the cameras, and I'm like, okay, but, you know, and I told them about it. And a couple of them tried to say, like, oh, God has nothing to do with the Constitution, and this, and I'm like, but you guys are constitutional officers. And they did it anyway. And that sheriff was at my house that day, and I videotaped them they actually called me and told me to open up the door. I'm like, I'm not inside. I was right there at the park at my house watching them, and I videotaped them flying in my door, and I rode by my bicycle, and I told them good morning. And when he saw me, when I by the time I turned around, he ran into the street, and it's like, I'm not on the property, so you can't even arrest me.
And that was the sheriff himself, huh?
That was the sheriff himself. He came himself because I had wrote him a letter saying that he's going to be violating my due process of law, blah blah blah, and I had that certified to him. So I guess he wanted to make sure he wanted to arrest me. I don't have an arrest record, and he was there. and I told him, I said, good morning.
See if you can get copies of that paperwork to Jim or Jan, or you know, so they can send it to John, because I wanna just confer with him and see if there's something that can't be done to get you out of that. You're not gonna do anything in the state court. You're in Florida,
yeah,
right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, do that. Do what you can. They don't have to be perfect. Run them through a cop's machine and send us so that we can do it.
I'll fax it to you.
They did.
Yeah. I will fax it to you.
That's fine. Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Very good.
Have a good night. God bless. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so everybody, I guess that brings us to the end of the queue, and I'm going to go ahead and close down. It's been good. I didn't think we'd make it to almost 12, but we did, and we certainly had a lot to talk about. So come back next week and we'll pick up where we left off. A lot of interesting stuff. Thank you, Brent. We appreciate it as always, and Jan and everybody else. Have a good night.
Conference is being recorded.